I must say, as I've just told Hunter, that I thought he offered us a most profound discussion of the role of the research university in the United States, and it is a statement that I hope will find wider audience. Our mission is to make recommendations for generating more support, both public and private. Although I've been involved with higher education for most of my life as student, teacher, legislator, or university president, I must confess this is the first time I have visited Ithaca, and I'm delighted to be here. For Cornell is one of the most respected institutions of higher learning in the world, with great academic strength in a wide range of fields. I have had, let me say, the privilege of knowing several of Cornell's leaders over the years: Jim Perkins, with whom I shared a keen interest in international studies; Frank Rhodes, with whom and his wife Rosa, as well as with another speaker at this symposium, Chancellor Joe Wyatt of Vanderbilt and his wife Faye; and my contemporary as a student at Oxford nearly 50 years ago, Steve Muller. My wife and I, several years ago, had a fascinating trip to the People's Republic of China. Yuri Bronfenbrenner, whom I saw this morning, who often testified before my congressional committee on Head Start and other child development issues, and Hank DeLay, with whom I worked during his service in the administrations of Governors Cuomo and Kerry, and with whom I had also earlier worked on the National Commission on Financing Post-Secondary Education. And finally, of course, I feel privileged to join you in honoring an eminent statesman of American science and engineering and former president of this university, who adds luster to the name of Cornell, Dale Corson. Now, I'm going to address the subject of this conference from the perspective of my own experiences. I was, as you've been told, for 22 years a member of the United States Congress, where on the Committee on Education and Labor I took part in writing all of the legislation enacted during that period to assist schools, colleges, and universities, libraries, museums, the arts and the humanities, and to provide services for the very young, the elderly, the disabled. Yesterday I was delighted at the airport to be greeted by one of my former constituents in Indiana, Cornell's distinguished diplomatic historian, of whom Dr. Rawlings spoke earlier, Walter Lefebvre, as well as to see another eminent Cornellian, whom I have known since having come to New York, the famed neuroscientist Fred Plum. And I was glad also to see this morning Frank Press, and though I haven't seen him yet, I see that Bill Bowen is also scheduled to take part in these proceedings. In 1980, I was defeated for election to a 12th term in Ronald Reagan's landslide victory over President Jimmy Carter. I may say, as an aside, as a working politician for much of my life, that as I was the majority whip at the time, number three in the hierarchy of leadership, and as Tip O'Neill, the speaker who had appointed me, I think I was the last appointed whip, voluntarily retired from Congress, and as Jim Wright of Texas, the then majority leader, was forced out, had I been reelected, I'd have been the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and my name is not Newt Gingrich. Shortly thereafter, I was invited to become president of New York University, the nation's largest private or independent university, a position in which I served for 11 years. And succinctly put, my goal for NYU was to transform what had been a regional, that is to say New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, commuter school into a national and international residential research university. And I think it's fair to say that that goal has been accomplished. Beyond experience as a legislator and university leader, I've served on several colleges and university boards of trustees, and as I said, on the National Commission on Financing Post-Secondary Education, where I chaired the Subcommittee on Graduate Education, the American Council on Education's Commission on National Challenges to Higher Education, and the Carnegie Commission on Science, Technology, and Government. Today, as you've also been told, I chair, by appointment of President Clinton, the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities, which is a group of some 40 persons, private citizens, and heads of federal departments and agencies with some cultural program. Our mission is to make recommendations for generating more support, both public and private, for these two fields in the United States. And 2 years ago, the President's Committee, of which the First Lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton, is honorary chair, released Creative America, a report containing over 50 specific recommendations to generate support, and our proposals are subsumed in several categories. We called for a renewal for American philanthropy for the arts and the humanities, an assessment of the nation's preservation needs, and a plan to protect our cultural legacy, a public-private partnership to digitize cultural materials to make them available through the new technologies, a series of measures to strengthen education in the arts and the humanities, significant increases in funds for the National Endowments for the Arts, the Humanities, and the Museum Services Program, and a national forum on enhancing knowledge of other cultures, including educational and cultural exchanges. I chair as well the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a federally funded non-governmental organization that makes grants to private organizations working for free and fair elections, independent judiciary, independent media, and the other components of democracy in countries where democracy either does not exist or is struggling to survive. In fact, last week I was in Amman, Jordan, speaking about just these matters at the World Conference on Religion and Peace. I shall not here recite a further litany of such engagements, but rather, against the background of involvements of this kind, make some observations about the research university in the United States as we look to the next century and the next millennium. I'll not pretend to be exhaustive, I hope instructive. I want to say something of the following subjects: international education, the impact of technology on higher education, liberal arts education, the financing of universities with particular attention to philanthropic support, and finally, a suggestion for university attention to a subject I believe important but neglected. I don't intend to say much about science. Others here far more knowledgeable than I will address that question. In respect of each of these matters, as I say, I'll refer to my own experience. An important concern of mine in Congress was international education. And a generation ago, in 1966, I authored and President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the International Education Act to provide federal funds to colleges and universities in the United States for teaching and research about countries and cultures other than our own. And although President Johnson signed the bill into law, Congress never appropriated funds to implement it. And I think that at least one of the reasons, I do not say the only one, for the troubles the United States has suffered in recent years in Iraq, Vietnam, Central America, and elsewhere, is ignorance of those peoples and societies. Commitment to international studies is, I know, deep at Cornell, where you have a most impressive range of such programs both here and abroad. Indeed, I am sure that all of us will agree, as Hunter Rawlings was suggesting, that the changing structure of the international economy demands that the United States prepare men and women knowledgeable about other countries. But international markets are not the only reason. As the lone political and military superpower in the world, we also need persons who understand other nations and their cultures in positions of leadership in our government. And I hope that that will not, in this election season, be taken as a partisan observation. Think for a moment of some of the trouble spots in the world that in recent years have engaged the interests of the United States, and in some cases still do. Vietnam, Iraq, Iran, India, Indonesia, China, Korea. How well do we really know these countries, their languages, their histories, their cultures? Do we really understand the origins of the fighting in Kosovo, the background of the battle between Serbs and Albanians? Do we even know how to find Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan on the map, and why these newly independent republicans may be important to our own national security? Before recent developments, how many Americans had ever heard of East Timor? Certainly, as president of New York University, I worked to bolster the university's international offerings. Already strong in the study of French civilization, we established the Alexander S. Onassis Center for Hellenic Studies and the Casa Italiana Zerilli Marimo. We created a center for Japan, U.S. Business and Economic Studies and the Skirball Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies. Because I had written my PhD at Oxford on the anarcho-syndicalist movement in Spain from the mid-1920s through the first year of the Spanish Civil War, I obviously had a particular interest in Spain. And in 1983, I awarded his first honorary degree from a foreign university to King Juan Carlos. 2 years ago, in the presence of their majesties, the King and Queen Sophia, and of the First Lady of the United States, Mrs. Clinton, We dedicated the King Juan Carlos I of Spain Center at NYU, a center dedicated to the study of the economics, history, and politics of modern Spain and of the Spanish-speaking world. And I'm pleased to say that already in its brief life, the King Juan Carlos Center has mounted a rich and lively program of lectures, seminars, and other activities. I add that I myself have 5 times this year visited Spain to speak in Alcalá de Henares, Barcelona, Cádiz, Ibiza, and Madrid. Here, let me tell you of a venture that may illustrate what I believe American colleges and universities can and should increasingly do. 38 years ago, as a young congressman with another member of the Education Committee of the House of Representatives, I visited Argentina to inquire into the potential contribution of universities in Latin America to President Kennedy's Alliance for Progress. In Buenos Aires, we met the President of the Republic, the Rector of the National University, who happened to have been brothers, as well as other prominent figures in Argentine life, and on our return to Washington, wrote a report with recommendations for United States policy toward higher education in Latin America. Last year, nearly 4 decades later, I was invited to return to Buenos Aires to address the National Academy of Education of Argentina. And in my talk, I argued for forging what I described as triangular relationships among colleges and universities in the United States, Latin America, and Spain. For as modern democratic Spain is more and more engaged economically in Latin America, and with continuing U.S. investment in the region, why not add to these triangular economic links triangular college and university connections as well? Consider, if you will, that with 28 million Spanish speakers, Spanish is now the second language of the United States. In fact, within a few years, there would be more Spanish speakers in the United States than Spain. This fact for institutions of higher learning in our country means new and exciting opportunities. Why not explore them? I'm glad to say that we at NYU are already planning a 3-way collaboration with the University of Buenos Aires and universities in Barcelona to focus on the study of urban problems. Hunter, there's always a danger if you make a speech, somebody may pay attention to it. I'm sure that you at Cornell have similar relationships that you find appropriate to your own academic mission, even as I believe that research universities in the United States generally should invest serious resources in teaching and research about other societies, cultures, and languages. And here, surely, the United States should lead. Yet I am distressed to say, with respect to a significant dimension of international education, cultural and scholarly exchanges, U.S. government support is at its lowest in years. Some programs, such as Arts America, that makes possible our sending cultural groups abroad, have been abolished, and others, such as the Fulbright exchanges, seriously diminished. Indeed, you may be interested to know that the executive director of the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities is Harriet Mayer Fulbright, the senator's widow. It is indeed because of concern about this declining support that we on the President's Committee, in cooperation with another Oxford contemporary and friend, the distinguished librarian of Congress, James H. Billington, will be hosting a conference at the library early next year to bring together persons knowledgeable about cultural and educational exchanges to develop some constructive approaches for approaching this situation. Only a few months ago in Madrid, I spoke to European and Latin American university rectors about new developments in international education. And among the matters I discussed was the rise of profit-making educational ventures, often, if not usually, utilizing technology. For one cannot pick up an issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education, or for that matter, perhaps The Economist, without seeing articles describing new applications of technology to post-secondary education, as well as advertisements of business firms offering education courses through one form or another of information technology. Indeed, I could take the rest of my time this morning with you citing specific examples of distance learning courses being offered in various countries aimed at both domestic users and across national borders. Some of the sponsors will be familiar to you, to cite just 3, in the United States, Phoenix University and the Sylvan Learning Systems, and in the United Kingdom, the Open University. To illustrate the aim of Sylvan Learning, its leaders say, is to build a network of private for-profit universities in Europe and Latin America. And Joseph Duffy, the former director of the United States Information Agency, now, as you may know, leads Sylvan Learning, which he says is a response to a combination of exploding demand for education and lack of resources and political will on the part of governments to invest in higher education. Says Duffy, we are not talking here about some great wave of the future, but of a broadening of the education marketplace to increase access. Another instance of innovations in international education is the current move by research universities in 7 countries to form a commercial corporation, Universitas 21. The purpose of the network will be to enable its member universities to take advantage of business opportunities too complex or large for any one of them. In fact, I must add a distance learning project from my own New York University, because this year we are inaugurating NYU Online, a for-profit subsidiary corporation to be operated by our School of Continuing and Professional Studies, which is already the leading private center of nonprofit continuing education in the United States, with some 60,000 students currently taking courses. The factors driving NYU Online are not surprisingly identical to the ones fueling such projects elsewhere. The availability of innovative technologies that make distance learning possible. The need for a workforce prepared to compete in the new knowledge-based economy. The importance of developing modes that are more cost-effective than traditional classroom-based models of teaching. I observe, moreover, that NYU is one of 15 of the largest research universities in the United States, including MIT, Stanford, Illinois, Pennsylvania, UCLA, and the University of California at Berkeley, that will work together to market their distance education efforts through a central directory on the World Wide Web listing all their online programs. Coordinated by the University of Washington, r1.edu, the new portal for distance learning courses is called, will hit the web, I understand, within a few months. Now, I shall certainly not attempt to pass judgment on the impact and quality of these or other instances of distance learning or technology-based forms of education. The reasons I have listed for them represent their potential advantages. But you and I know that critics of cyberspace learning have already voiced apprehension at these developments. How the web will affect the quality of education is probably the number one question. How, for example, are such courses to be accredited? Because accreditation of programs may be the most effective means of measuring academic quality and can directly influence allocation of institutional resources, accreditation will be key to the future of distance learning. I have, in fact, just agreed to serve on a committee to evaluate procedures for accreditation of universities in Latin America. Another question, will steps be taken, especially where the university program is linked to a for-profit company, to prevent conflicts of interest and protect the institution's academic integrity? Yet another, what about the lack of the face-to-face human interaction between and among students and professors, which characterizes the traditional campus experience? All these questions are relevant to distance learning programs, whether domestic or international in scope. And I believe that a challenge for those of us who are champions of international education is to devise ways and means of discussing such issues and others, and developing effective approaches to dealing with them. For wisely harnessed, the new technologies, coupled with the globalized economy of which Dr. Rawlings was speaking, and sharply rising demand for knowledge, can bring great benefit to millions of people in every part of the world. I've touched on both international education and technology as factors that both do and should affect the shape of research universities in the United States. Let me turn to another matter, money. During my years in Congress, we fashioned a variety of measures to help students finance a college or university education. Student guaranteed loans, Pell Grants, work-study programs, for example. And of course, as most of you here know better than I, the federal government expends billions of dollars for university-based research, especially in the sciences, and more especially still for medical research. On the House Committee with Responsibility for Higher Education Legislation, I was a strong champion of federal support for both public and private colleges and universities, and I still am. For one of the reasons for the strength of American post-secondary institutions is their diversity, their pluralistic base, both in the ways in which they are governed and are financed. And in my judgment, we need vigorously to seek support for higher education from both government, federal and state, and private philanthropy, individuals, business, foundations. And certainly one of the responsibilities of university presidents in this country is to pay careful attention to what's happening in Washington, D.C. and state capitals, and to make their voices heard on decisions by governments that affect their institutions. But I want this morning to focus on philanthropy, because we all know, too, that one of the principal obligations of an American college or university president is to raise private funds for his campus. When I came to New York University in 1981, I learned that NYU had received in contributions from private sources the year before my arrival a total of $23 million, a sum I thought far too low for a university of its size and location. So I announced a fundraising target of $1 million a week for 100 weeks, and we achieved that goal. And then in 1984, I said that NYU would seek to raise in private contributions by the year 2000 a total of $1 billion. And we did so, not in the 15 years allotted, but in 10. And it was due in large measure to the generation of private funds in sums unprecedented in the history of the university that we were able to make great progress at New York University in recent years in building student housing, thereby changing radically the demography of the student body, endowing professorial chairs, providing student loans and scholarships, creating laboratories, telecommunications, and computing facilities, and establishing international study centers. And I'm pleased to say that in the last academic year, New York University received gifts totaling $247 million, a new record. So seriously do we take fundraising at NYU that our School of Continuing and Professional Studies is now starting courses in philanthropy. We want to prepare persons for careers in nonprofit organizations with a curriculum that includes how to write proposals, understand the tax implications of contributions, and work with foundations, corporations, and governments. So strongly do I feel about the indispensable place of philanthropy in American life, especially for colleges and universities, of course, that whenever I have an opportunity to speak at universities in other countries, I preach the gospel of giving. More concretely, I urge that university leaders abroad press their political leaders to adopt tax incentives to encourage contributions to cultural, educational, and health institutions. So I was delighted to read last week in the Financial Times an article indicating that the British government will at long last change the law to allow benefactors to cut their tax bills while making large gifts in shares and bonds, a step, said the FT, that could revolutionize the funding of Britain's elite universities. I was pleased, too, that one of the authorities cited as championing this move was C. Duncan Rice, principal of the University of Aberdeen, and someone I had appointed several years ago as Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at NYU. As a matter of fact, you may remember some years ago when Margaret Thatcher started cutting the funds, the government funds for colleges and universities in the UK, there was a response, at least on the part of Oxford University, my own university, that involved a campaign to raise private money. Never done before, and I was the only American who took part in the launch of the campaign at the Sheldonian Theater. And I said, I have two messages for you. First, you must make the point that Oxford is indispensable to the future of this country, which I believe. Second, I said, words that will not fall easily on British ears. You have to ask. And Oxford began to ask, and now they're doing very well, thank you very much. They had not understood the power of the name of Oxford, the magnet that it represents. It seems to me that with the development of a common market, common currency, and common central bank, the time has come for the European Union to shape a Europe-wide policy of tax incentives to stimulate philanthropy. And here I remind you that one of the chief recommendations of the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities was for a renewal of philanthropic support for these fields. According to the latest issue of Giving USA 1999, contributions to human services in the United States reached $16 billion in 1998, up 27% from 1997. But giving, on the other hand, to the arts, culture, and humanities was $10.5 billion in 1998, a decline adjusted for inflation of over 2%. And with such trends, you can better understand why the President's Committee urges that in their decisions on giving, benefactors, individuals, corporations, foundations, include arts and humanities organizations and activities. And of course, among the citadels of the humanities in the United States, as Hunter was saying, are universities. Indeed, the committee found that the arts and the humanities are more dependent on private giving than many other segments of the nonprofit community in our country. For example, many performing arts groups receive as much as 40% of their total income from donations, compared to 3 to 5% for hospitals, and an average of less than 20% for many other nonprofit organizations. Now, why at a conference on the future of the research university, where so much of the discussion will be directed, I'm sure, to the importance of financing the sciences, do I speak of the arts and the humanities? I do so not only because it is far more difficult to raise money for these fields in the United States than for the sciences, and here I speak of both government and philanthropic dollars, but also because of the central role of liberal education in a university that pretends to be serious. When in 1981 I was inaugurated 13th president of New York University, and I made the point that that letter 13 did not really upset me. You know the phrase triskaidekaphobia, which means fear of the letter 13, although I'm glad to say that my office was on the 12th floor and that there is no 13th floor in the library. One of my pledges was to strengthen the liberal arts, because I believe then, and I still do, that it is through the requirements of a first-class liberal arts education that our colleges and universities provide society its most valuable resource, people who can think logically and write lucidly. It is the arts and the sciences that prepare people not only to enter the world equipped to pursue their careers, but also to act as intelligent, creative, and honorable human beings. Now, you and I know that during the last generation, the liberal arts fell out of favor, at least in part because they were seen as poorly suited to the challenges of the contemporary world. How could the study of philosophy or history or English literature prepare one for a career? Yet I would remind such students that many of them will have more than one career during their lifetimes, and that learning how to learn, one of the fruits of a liberal education, endows individuals with the flexibility to change careers as their interests, needs, and ambitions change. I do not mean to imply that the arts and the humanities serve solely to enhance professional competency, although I'm prepared to make such a case, but a broadly based liberal arts education is exceedingly useful in enabling us to decide what we want to do and understand the implications of our choices. For without a liberal education as a foundation, we run the risk of having scientists, engineers, makers of social policy, and military and political leaders who see problems as obstructions rather than as opportunities. And there's another reason that a humanistic education is important. Since the golden age of Greece, and your president is an authority on that period, and as I told him, my father was born in Greece. I was the first native-born American of Greek origin elected to Congress. What we now call liberal learning has been expected to contribute to developing an individual sense of civic responsibility. And certainly no democracy can survive unless those who express their choices are able to choose wisely. No democracy can survive unless we rely on the processes of reason, accommodation, and civil discourse, processes made possible only with an educated populace. And I suggest to you that the kinds of problems with which we in the United States must now deal make a broadly based liberal education not a luxury, but a necessity. The issues that the American people face today, indeed all of humankind, the threat of nuclear war, the ethics of genetic engineering, the care of the aging, the very young, the poor, the handicapped in our society, cannot be left solely to the experts. We, all of us, must educate ourselves to participate fully and intelligently in the public debate over these and other crucial social and ethical questions. Now, as we consider the future of the research university, I've been speaking of international education, the impact of technology and on colleges and universities, the importance of philanthropic support, the place of liberal learning in the life of the university, and I've taken the liberty of illustrating my observations from personal experience. The research universities of the United States are, again, to recall what President Rawlings said, the envy of the world, but we cannot take them for granted. We must continue to press for the resources essential to their work, even as we must also insist on criticizing them and, where necessary, taking steps to improve them. Now, I told you at the outset of my remarks that I would also touch on a subject I believe worthy of attention by at least some of America's research universities, but one that gets very little. It is an issue that I addressed in 1982 at the first commencement ceremonies at which I presided as president of New York University. I observed that the preamble to the Constitution of the United States declares that one of the basic purposes of our government is to provide for the common defense, in the familiar phrase, that there is a widespread consensus in our country today that we must have a strong national defense to assure our freedoms in a dangerous world, I believe few would deny. But in recent years, during the administrations of both political parties, there have been more and more questions about the objectives of our defense policy and the methods by which we as a nation make decisions about our security needs. Consider these headlines from only recent weeks from the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal, front page. Ground zero, military must change for the 21st century. The question is how? U.S. choice, Terminator, peacekeeping global cop, or combination of roles. Military must change for the 21st century, but how? Again, this one from also the Wall Street Journal op-ed page. Prepared for the last Cold War, the Pentagon has never really come to terms with its new day-to-day duty, what one might term imperial policing, keeping the peace in places like Bosnia, Kosovo, and Kuwait. Again, in the Washington Post, front page. Panel faults anti-missile program on many issues. Report by experts cites high risk of failure. And only last week in the New York Times, U.S. and NATO allies divided over defense needs. Clearly, there are very important questions here to be asked. It should be obvious, but I think it is not, that the billions that we expend for national security affect the country in a diversity of ways. The defense budget has an impact on the national economy, on jobs, business, on local communities, on scientific and industrial research, on race relations, on our supply of educated manpower, on our colleges and universities. The defense budget directly affects the lives of each of us in one way or another. Indeed, the defense budget of the government of the United States has become so consequential to the lives of us all, to the economy of our nation, and the nature of our society, that in my judgment, we must lift the subject to a far higher level of visibility in the arena of national debate. In one of the articles I cited, this front page piece in a series of Wall Street Journal articles on military spending, the question is posed, what sort of military would we build for the 21st century? The answer, says the writer, depends on what role America wants to play in the world, adding, in Pentagon offices, war college classrooms, and think tank outposts, three major options have emerged, end of quote. What I think striking in that analysis is that not cited as engaged in considering so profoundly complex and important matter are the research universities of the nation. In my judgment, it is high time for us to bring the capabilities of at least some of our research universities to bear on the entire spectrum of issues raised by the making of policy for our national defense. And I'm not arguing for or against any particular weapon system. As a member of Congress, unless one was on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee or the Armed Services Committee, one had very little idea of what was in the defense budget. And one often paid attention to whether or not a particular amendment offered had an impact on the production of a weapons item in one's own congressional district or state in making a judgment. In my view, we need to find ways to encourage a broader, deeper, more thorough understanding of the structure of decision-making for the security policy of our country. I have in mind a variety of mechanisms, seminars, lectures, conferences, courses. Among the participants in such efforts should be persons who have served in key positions in the White House, the Departments of Defense and State, and our intelligence agencies, as well as members of the House and Senate recognized as knowledgeable in defense matters. And although indispensable to such dialogue, persons like these would not be enough. We need also to engage leaders in business and industry, labor, and we must certainly include members of our university faculties from the disciplines of economics and political science, physics and mathematics, sociology and psychology, history and anthropology, and philosophy and theology as well. The involvement of America's research universities in the consideration of how our defense policy is made would bring much more openness, illumination, and deeper insight to a dimension of American life that, while of fundamental importance to our own citizens and all humanity, remains so little understood. Perhaps you here at Cornell, where I know you have some of the world's leading authorities in these disciplines that I have mentioned, could take the lead. Ladies and gentlemen, let me conclude these remarks. I have attempted, based on my own experience, to touch on just a few of the issues that I think significant as we look to the future of research universities in the United States. In doing so, I recall that just 49 years ago this fall, a group of American students ready to set sail from New York for Southampton and Oxford were honored at a reception at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. Our host was Frank Adelot, then director of the Institute and also secretary of the American Rhodes Scholarships. Among the persons who greeted us were J. Robert Oppenheimer and John Louis von Neumann. We were in tall grass. Expecting a visit from a schoolmate from South Bend, my hometown, then studying at Princeton, I had my eye on the door when in walked a man wearing a wool pullover hat, chinos, heavy sweater, and sandals. We fell back as if a divinity had entered the room. It was Albert Einstein. Adelot, a fellow Hoosier, by the way, said not Professor Einstein or Dr. Einstein, but as if addressing an institution, which indeed he was, "Einstein, what have you got to tell these boys?" The room hushed. Einstein paused and then uttered just one sentence. "The most important thing," he said, "is that they think for themselves." Well, if we who are leaders of America's institutions of higher learning can more powerfully teach people throughout their lives to think for themselves, we shall, I believe, be fulfilling the purposes of a liberal education and of a research university. Thank you very much.